This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Time now for the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. And now, here she is, the smart, the sexy, the savvy, divine Miss C.
And welcome to the show. Now, today I have a very interesting show for you. I want to talk about senior citizen abuse because it's something that happens a lot, but people don't do anything about it. So it's not a pleasant topic, but it's one that you should know about. If you think you may know someone that's being abused, please listen to the show. Today I have with me Mike Mahoney. He's from the Florida Department of Children and Families Adult Protective Services Division. I want to welcome you to the show, Mike, and please tell us about your background and your division.
Will do, Lori. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's a long title, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. The Adult Protective Services Division is something that's right up your alley if you want to talk about this topic. Before I talk about what we do, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I've been with the state of Florida with the Department of Children and Families, DCF, for 17 years. And there are times where I wake up and I feel like one of our clients. I don't know what happened. I don't know why I'm here.
Okay.
How did that time go by? I started out as a child protective investigator back in late 1999. And then I worked in our client relations office where, we handle some of the concerns from the community. And then I ended up in a very unique position where I handled human trafficking issues and missing children. The state of Florida, we protect, part of our job is to protect adults. Part of our job is to protect children. We get involved in a lot of protection types of things. And then in 2011... I ended up in Adult Protective Services as an Adult Protective Investigator. Now I'm what they call the Human Services Program Specialist. I handle a variety of different things. I do a lot of community events, and I help field train investigators. But before that, I was an investigator for 4 years. It was one of the most important changes in my life based on my personal experiences. My own father... he was kind of famous in the community. He was the spokesman for Tampa Electric Company, and he ended up getting a rare form of dementia called Pick's disease, and he ended up dying at the age of 52. Well, when I became an adult protective investigator, I ended up interacting with adults like him who have suffered perhaps a cognitive impairment, or they have family members that are trying to take care of them, and finding it difficult to do that. So it was almost like a light bulb went off that, this is where I should have been all of this time with DCF. Perhaps when my mother was struggling with my father, I could have provided her more assistance. I would have had more knowledge about it. What we do in Adult Protective Services is protect the vulnerable adults in our community. That's something that we're going to talk about, I think, in more detail. But there's a statutory definition about what a vulnerable adult is. But our job is to protect vulnerable adults from abuse, neglect, exploitation, and even self-neglect, which we can actually tie into senior abuse, and we can tie all those together. It's all technically abuse.
Okay. All right. I mean, it's a difficult topic. And how do you handle that every day? Because, I mean, you must feel good because you've helped people, but do you feel like you've been hit by a truck in a way because there's so much stuff coming in? You're going, I'd be sitting there going, how can people do this to other people? I mean, I'm with a dog rescue, and I go, how can people do this to animals? But you're dealing with the human context of it. Mm-hmm. What's that like?
Well, it's – I wouldn't say that it's – when it's something that you do for a living, it's like any profession where when you do something for a living, it reduces the impact to you emotionally. I guess you think it might anyway. Who knows how it really affects you over time and what it does to your psyche. But for me personally, 17 years with the Department of Children and Families, it becomes a mission. It becomes your focus. It doesn't become something that you – sit around and get upset about. You don't get upset about it. You don't think about it. You think about what your job is and what you have to do.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we're specifically talking about seniors today, and actually I recently just did a show as a side note on human trafficking, another difficult topic. Hard to believe it happens even in the United States today. But let's talk about the term abuse in that context, and also discuss the law regarding abuse.
The Department of Children and Families operates, in terms of the adult services side, we operate under Chapter 415 of the Florida statutes. So everything that we do, we do in accordance with that law, with the laws of Chapter 415, and we have our own operating procedures. So what the most important aspects to think about what abuse is to us when we investigate abuse is that it has to be a willful act or a threat of harm, and it has to be by a certain kind of person. One thing that the community doesn't really understand when it comes to adult protective services investigations is you have to have a certain degree of relationship to the individual. Not only does the individual have to be a vulnerable adult, the alleged perpetrator has to have a specific kind of relationship. It has to be a relative, a caregiver, or a household member. And the statute defines it as a willful or threatened act by a relative, caregiver, or household member, which is likely to cause a significant impairment to the vulnerable adult's physical, mental, or emotional health. What are we talking about? We're talking about things like bruises. We're talking about bone fractures. We're talking about marks on the body that may be suspicious. You know, we will see sometimes marks around the wrists or the ankles from perhaps the vulnerable adult is being tied up. That can also tie into confinement and bizarre punishments. We investigate all those different types of things. We look at what is the dynamic between the vulnerable adult and this alleged perpetrator. Do they have a good relationship? Are they comfortable? Or is there some fear that we're detecting from the vulnerable adult, which we call the victim in our it's the alleged victim or victim in our investigations. We always interview the victims alone. We never interview them with the alleged perpetrator. We give them every opportunity to tell us what's happening to try to keep them safe.
Right, because they'd be too nervous with the person in the room. If it's the abuser, they're not going to say anything.
Right.
Does the law also cover people who are, say, like in assisted living homes?
Absolutely. Okay. The department investigates allegations in homes, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, group homes, probably something else, hospitals. We routinely visit the psychiatric units in the hospitals.
That's gotta be hard. Do you keep statistics on, like, for example, if a particular assisted living home, you start getting a lot of complaints from people, like, do you kind of know, like, who the troublemakers are, so to speak, when it comes to certain places?
Well, we actually work in close partnership with other agencies. We have a sister agency, the Agency for Healthcare Administration, which you'll hear people refer to them as ACA. Now, ACA actually licenses the facilities. So if we one of our protocols is to, once the investigation is completed, we always send the final report, actually, and the initial allegations. We send them something in the beginning and at the end, basically, to let them know what we found about the facility. ACA handles their license. DCF doesn't license these facilities.
Okay.
Our goal is basically the alleged victim and what has happened to them. So you may have, let's say, a nursing home with 100 residents. We do assess the environment, and we want to make sure if anything else we might see, we definitely address. But we're there about the victim and our allegation, and we want to make sure that individual is safe. But we absolutely will share that with the Agency for Healthcare Administration, who I know compiles. They keep track of how many times they get reports on facilities from us. They'll do their own independent investigation. In fact, if they have concerns about our investigation, they'll go do their own investigation, and they hold the license, and they can find that facility. They can give them a certain amount of time to make changes and then follow up to make sure they do them. They can close it.
I'm thinking back years ago. I remember watching some TV show about senior abuse in assisted living homes, where family members would hide a hidden camera, mm-hmm. and they would actually be able to show, you know, that the person who worked there might be kicking the other person or you know, doing something that was abusive to them. And if they hadn't put the camera there, well, you wouldn't know anything about it. And so, if someone has dementia, I would wonder. You know, how do you know if that person is telling the truth or if they're just imagining it? As sad as that is to say, because I'm sure that's part of your job, is to dig through and figure out what is actually happening to this person.
Absolutely. We actually assess three primary things when we do an investigation. The first thing we assess is if the alleged victim, the vulnerable adult, if they have the capacity to consent. If they don't have the capacity to consent, obviously, there's a concern about any information we get from them. How reliable is it? And that's not to say that, say, somebody with dementia doesn't have capacity to consent. There's a misnomer that somebody has dementia and they lack competency. That's not the case. There's different stages of dementia. So if they're early in, if they're early in that, or even moderately into the stages, they may still have that capacity to consent. So we do assess their capacity to consent. We interview any sources that might be of use. We obviously interview the alleged perpetrator, if known. Often in facilities, we may not know what happened to the individual. It might have been an accident. We're talking about some fragile people, and okay. they get bruises for different reasons, and they can even get fracture a bone just from rolling in bed.
Osteoporosis, right.
Yeah.
Right.
We still investigate it to determine if something did happen. We assess, besides capacity to consent, we assess the risk to the individual. Do they appear to be at risk? Do they appear to have all their needs met? Are they safe? Especially if they are in a facility. Generally, if you're in a facility, we consider you to be pretty safe. Not so much at home. If you have a caregiver at home taking care of you, it's not as easy for – we don't feel as sure that you're probably safe. We have to really dig to make sure. Aside from risk and capacity, we do gather evidence. We write a final report. That final report, as I said, goes to different places. We may share it with law enforcement, with the state attorney's office, with the Agency for Healthcare Administration, with the Department of Health. With the Office of the Attorney General. There's various entities we share those reports with.
Okay, gotcha. Now let's talk about statistics. Can you give me some statistics regarding abuse?
Absolutely. I pulled some, actually, because I'm getting older. I can't remember. I do have some great statistics for you. Let's talk a little bit about perpetrators in terms of who are the perpetrators in these cases. Interesting to know that, and as we said, we investigate in-home and institutional. About 80% of our institutional cases are a facility case, hospital, an ALF or a nursing home usually. In-home cases, 33.7 in the last fiscal year, 33.75% of the alleged perpetrators where we did find that abuse or neglect occurred that was a son or a daughter.
That's sad. Yes. That's a sad statistic.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
I hate to tell you that one.
Yeah.
Now, something to keep in mind. This is an interesting statistic. When we talk about the most common things we investigate, we're going to talk about physical injury, which is abuse. That could be bruises. It's a physical injury catch-all category. Or inadequate supervision, which is neglect. We will often investigate an allegation of inadequate supervision where a caregiver is not providing adequate overall care to the individual. Perhaps they are not giving them, they're not giving them food, keeping them from getting hurt, they're letting them wander. We're going to talk about inadequate supervision, we're going to talk about exploitation, we're going to talk about self-neglect, we're going to talk about those four things, because it's a kind of a shocking statistic to hear 33.75% of the time where there's abuse, a third of every three cases, a son or a daughter is doing this to their...
Who's reporting, in those cases, who's reporting it? I mean, is it the person themselves that's calling and saying, you know, my son or daughter, they're not taking care of me, I'm living in this house? Or is it usually somebody outside who's observing it and is questioning, something's wrong?
Well, we'll talk about calling that hotline and reporter anonymity. So just in general, we'll talk about the kind of entities that call reports into our hotline. We can get calls from providers that go into the home to provide home health. Often if there's a caregiver taking care of the vulnerable adult, they will get some assistance from a home health agency. So you may have a home health employee that has concerns. You may have neighbors. We often will get calls from family members, other family members who have concerns about how they're, say in this kind of case, their sibling is taking care of their loved one. There's a variety. Anyone you can think of can call in a report. But generally, ideally it's somebody who knows that it exists. Because the one thing, we'll talk about another statistic in a minute about how many reports we get. We want you to have a belief that it's happening, a credible belief that it's happening. As far as those four that I talked about, inadequate supervision in the last fiscal year, there were 17,213 reports about inadequate supervision in Florida. Only 661 had findings, and these are in-home cases. We're talking just in-home cases. 661 had findings, which was a little bit less than 4%. Okay. Exploitation, there were 11,278 with only 888 that had findings, 8%. Physical injury, 5% of the cases of the almost 10,000 cases had findings. Self-neglect, the most reports we get are self-neglect. We had 18,763 reports of self-neglect. Self-neglect is about a third of the reports we get. And we can get any number, we can get about 20 different kinds of allegations that are broken down. Self-neglect is a third of
right,
all
that's,
of them.
That's a lot.
21% of our self-neglect cases were verified for self-neglect, meaning, yes, the individual is neglecting themselves. Yes.
Well, is it mostly because they're older and they just can't take care of themselves? Because that's a big issue in this country with seniors is, where do you go? You're living on probably very limited Social Security, income. Where do you go to? Because you can't really afford, unless you're living with family members, how are you affording to live? And I think that's part of the problem.
Sure it is. It's actually amazing how many vulnerable adults we come into contact with that are on a fixed income and on an amount of money that you can't imagine how they make it, but they do. And there are a lot of community programs, depending on where you live.
Right.
With my position, I work in Pinellas and Pasco County in Florida. It's Circuit 6, and there are vast differences between those two counties on what's available. In Pinellas County, there's more access to, say, food pantries if you need that kind of help. The transportation system is better in Pinellas County.
Right, but Pasco's more rural, so you've got things spread out, and there's not as many people, not as much stuff.
So somebody might be at higher risk in Pasco County. They may have a higher risk of neglecting themselves. And the reason I wanted to point out that statistic is because we would rather have a family member or a caregiver helping them.
Right.
We would rather have them in the house helping them. You know, roughly less than 5% of the time, they may hurt that individual in some fashion. They may abuse or neglect or exploit them. But one out of every five of these vulnerable adults living on their own is going to neglect themselves.
But I know situations a lot of times where the senior citizen, the senior adult, doesn't want to feel like they're being a burden to their family. And that may kind of relate to that. They don't want to feel like, hey, I'm making them do all this. And, you know, I'm supposed to be taking care of them instead of them taking care of me. So some of it's got to be psychological, too.
Sure. And I could touch on just how many – just on our other – a little bit more statistics.
Sure.
So last fiscal year in Florida, Adult Protective Services handled 52,858 reports.
That's I hope you have a lot of people where you're working, because that's a lot of complaints.
Well, we're hiring right now in Pinellas County. So we do in-home versus institutional. I want to make sure I mention that. An interesting statistic, actually. So we had 52,000 in the last fiscal year. In 1994, 22,000. 30,000 difference. In fact, 10 years ago, We had only 43,000 reports. We've increased by 10,000 in 10 years. I think that's because of awareness. Well, and like right now, you know, right. A show like yours, you know,
try to make people aware of what it is.
Yes, so we thank you for that. It's a service because we can't help them if we don't know they exist and go see them.
Well, right. Well, it makes me think that if you have 54,000 complaints, there's probably double that because you probably have a lot of people who it's never even found or no one's tried to help them or complain about a situation. There's a lot of unknowns is what I'm trying to say.
Sure. One final statistic. That's exactly what you're talking about. There's estimates that there's as many as 5 million elders abused each year. And it's something – we'll talk about the vulnerable adult perhaps next. That's somebody that's 18 or older, not necessarily an elder. An elder can be defined by – generally we think about that as a 60-year-old, but different communities look at elder differently.
Okay.
But out of that 5 million, it's estimated that only 1 in 14, 7% are reported. That's nationwide. So 14%, that's not very good.
No, that's actually pretty bad. Yeah. So, I mean, if you're listening to the show and you know somebody at the end, we're going to give out some contact information so that you can help them. Now, talk to me about what is your quality assurance purpose and model?
That is a good question. It's unbelievable, actually. The investigation begins with our hotline accepting the report or not accepting the report, and it's filtered down to an investigator. It's filtered down to the local office and assigned to an investigator who responds, who by statutory requirement must locate and interview and assess that victim within 24 hours. We actually have a higher level response time, 3 hours. We refer to those as immediate responses. If the reporter feels like the vulnerable adult is in immediate danger, their investigator will respond within 3 hours, and our hotline may actually transfer that caller to law enforcement as well, so law enforcement can respond. Once the investigator has begun their investigation, they must submit a preliminary assessment of the situation within 6 days. In our area, the expectation is that you do that within 4 days so that it can be reviewed by your supervisor. So there is a supervisor review on every investigation within approximately 6 days. Once the supervisor will direct the investigator to do certain tasks to complete the investigation, and then the investigator will submit it for a final review. There's always a final review by the supervisor for every investigation. We have a higher level review that can also take place. That's often by an administrator. So you have an investigator assessment. You have always a supervisor level review. Then you may have a second higher level review. Then we have a standardized quality assurance team that works out of our regional offices that reviews completed investigations for policy and procedure. The very last question on their assessment is, did the vulnerable adult situation stabilize or improve? If they didn't, we didn't do our job. I can throw out another statistic for you, actually. It's about – in the last fiscal year, we measure reabuse after a verified abuse investigation, and the reabuse is at 1.5%. So one to two out of every 100 – may be re-abused. That might happen because the situation might not have been one where we would have found. We'll talk about our philosophical approach to how we handle investigations, because again, we want family members taking care of their loved ones. That's what we want. We know that if they're on their own and they have capacity to consent, we can't make them go to a facility. We can't make them do anything.
America.
You know, my first case that I ever took was a gentleman who was living in a tent in the woods.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and I remember calling my supervisor. This was back in 2011. And I said, well, what do I do? And he's like, does he have food? And I said, yes, he has food. Is he warm? Yeah, he's got a fire, you know?
He's
living in the woods. You know, what can I do about it? Nothing. He's as sharp as we are. He can do whatever he wants. It's America. So if somebody is in a situation that's not so good and they have capacity to consent, we will try to help them get to a safer situation if we feel that it's risky or if it's dangerous, but we can't make them go. Perhaps that is when there's reabuse down the road. About 1%, 1 to 2% of
tough
the time.
Tough situations, yeah. Well, what I want to do, stay with me because we're going to go to a commercial break and we'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
Consumers, do you have bad credit? Can't purchase a house or car? Paying too much in interest on your credit cards and loans? Scammed by credit repair companies? There is hope. You can get back on track and do it the right way. Call Credit Education Consultants today at 813-500-6064. That's 813-500-6064. Or go to crediteducationconsultants.com now and get the help you need. Don't delay. Call today. Mortgage reps and realtor inquiries are also welcomed.
Central Payment, your number one credit card merchant service provider in the industry. Providing e-commerce solutions, POS systems, standalone terminals, mobile apps, and much more, call Central Payment's James Carner at 813-777-4332. Looking for the lowest rates in the industry and number one customer service? Call Central Payment's James Carner at 813-777-4332. That's James Carner, 813-777-4332.
And we're back on the World of Lori Zook. If you've been listening, we've been talking about senior abuse. And I'm here with Mike Mahoney. He's from the Florida Department of Children and Families Adult Protective Services Division. And Mike, let's talk a little bit more. You talked earlier about vulnerable adults in the description. Talk about that a little bit. Who's a vulnerable adult?
Right. A vulnerable adult is somebody who – it used to be that it related to age along with numerous other things. But years ago, I'm guessing it was probably within the last 10 years, age no longer mattered. It doesn't. You can be 100 and not be a vulnerable adult. In fact, I had several cases with somebody that was – I had one that was 100 and two that were 101 that they weren't vulnerable adults.
Okay.
But a vulnerable adult can be 18. The actual definition is an individual that's 18 years or older that suffers from an impairment that makes they are not able to do some aspect of their daily living activities. It might be that they can't pay their bills. They can't walk without a walker or a cane. They may not be able to manage their medication properly. Somebody living at home who, say, uses a cane, okay, is a vulnerable adult.
So it doesn't have to be a senior citizen. It could be anyone 18 mm-hmm. or over for
right.
adult protective services. Okay.
Right. And the there are certain qualifying medical impairments. Someone with cerebral palsy is a vulnerable adult, per se.
Does your division help them get the help they need if they don't know how to get it?
Absolutely. We have investigators that investigate the allegations through our hotline, but we also have our own team of services counselors. They can do a variety of different things. Well, the investigator themselves can refer the vulnerable adult to different programs in the community. One common one that I often refer to is Meals on Wheels. You know, if they have trouble preparing meals but no trouble feeding themselves, it might be that they just need the microwave. And that's something okay. that we can always do. We do have this team of service counselors that can do something we call short-term case management. If, let's say, the vulnerable adult just needs a few fixes and they'll be on their way, maybe they need to establish a representative payee because they just don't pay their bills for whatever reason. Or they know they're not good with money, you know?
Right.
That's something I know you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And they need a rep payee, and our investigator might help them get that, or our services counselor might do that. Then we have a higher level of service interventions called protective services. That is a formal following of the vulnerable adult over time. Short-term case management might take a week to a month. Protective services might last years, where we help that individual to make sure they're safe and they're getting all their needs met, maybe to connect them with other service providers and help them find a facility if that's what they're interested in. We really spend most of our time, as we should, on high-risk situations. A certain percentage of our cases are high risk. The others, low to moderate risk situations where we can kind of manage the situation and let them get back to their life. Because that's why capacity to consent exists. It's so people have rights. They can do what they want. If they don't want our help, we're not going to make them take it. We're going to offer it. But we have high risk situations at times where immediate intervention is needed. Well, there's a lot of partnering happening in Florida when it comes to seniors and vulnerable adults in general. We can refer a high-risk situation to the Department of Elder Affairs, a sister agency, who, with us working together, we can get services into that to that individual immediately, the same day. If they can't bathe, if they can't make any food, if they can barely get out of bed and we deem it a high-risk situation, must be a high-risk situation based on our tools that we use, we can get services to them right away. And our goal is never – there is a misconception, I think, especially among our target group, that we want to take them out of their homes. We do not want to take them out of their homes.
They want to leave their homes. That's the problem. Yeah. Senior show, yeah. They don't want to leave.
Right. And we're not going to make them leave unless they lack capacity. If an individual lacks capacity and they're at high risk and they don't have supports necessary to be safe, we will contact law enforcement who will jointly make a decision to remove the individual and put them in a safe environment, and then we'll go to court and have the court support that. Or we may not be sure if that's the right thing to do, and we may go to court and petition the court to allow us to move that individual to a safe environment. This is the exception. Okay. This is not the rule, right?
Okay. How do you determine the mental capacity?
Well, the investigator will ask the then that leads me to a funny story, actually. The investigator will ask a series of questions to determine if the alleged victim that we're there to see, if they have if they're aware of time and
– what year it is.
Yeah. Do you know how old you are? What year is it? Do you know where you are? You know? And hopefully they know they're at home, you know, or
right.
Wherever they might be. Do you know who you are? Do you have children? What are their names? Who's your doctor? Then we'll ask higher-level questions to determine if they're aware of their resources. Do they understand that they have an income coming in? How do you pay your bills? Do you know what your limitations are? Do you what you're looking for is them to say, "Yep, I have high blood pressure and diabetes," and you know they'll rattle on the things.
Right.
So
right.
Can they make? Do they understand their resources, their limitations, their consequences? So this is not always easy to do. And I'll give you an example. So when I was an investigator. Unfortunately, we have to be on call.
24 hours a day kind of
yes,
thing?
Yes, 24/7.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Nobody closes ever in adult
okay.
services.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no yeah. one to take it. Yeah.
Yep. And I ended up getting a call, an immediate, at it was 2 in the morning. yeah, that
sorry,
made
I'm choke.
Joking.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And the police actually were on scene, and they called us in that situation. They were concerned about this elderly woman who they said was confused. They just said, something's wrong. She's confused. Everything looks fine here, but she's confused. And when I called them, because I didn't really want to get out of my pajamas and go see her, I called them to say, do I need to come right this minute? They said, no, we actually found a neighbor. Between the call to the hotline and my call to them, they found a neighbor who knows her to come stay with her. I said, I'll be there first thing in the morning. I got there around 7 in the morning. So I show up there, and the neighbor, The neighbor is there, and she says, I'm going to go home for a few minutes, take a shower and change while you talk to her. So I look at this lady. Her environment, she's got a beautiful house. It's very clean. She presents very well. She's very nice. When the neighbor left, she was just finishing getting dressed, and she came out into the living room. She's not quite finished yet dressing, and she says to me, why don't you have a seat, but in here, in this room, she says, have a seat. And I said, okay, I will. And I asked her a couple questions, and she answered them fine. So she finishes what she's doing, and I don't listen to her. I decide to walk around and look around. That's part of my job, right? So I go sit on this couch in the room next to the room I was in, and there's a cat sleeping there.
Okay.
So I go to pet it, and I jump out of my shoes. Oh, one thing that I forgot was how she told me to watch out because her dog gets nervous and poops. So I go sit on this couch, and I go to pet this cat, and it's dead, okay? It's like frozen, right, on the couch. So I'm like, I wonder if she had it, like, taxidermied, you know? Maybe that's why. But I'm so freaked out by it that I jump off the couch and go to where she told me to go, and I step in poop.
Oh, no.
So I'm in the kitchen tracking it on her tile of her beautiful house, and she comes out, and she's basically like, what did you do? Oh, no. She's such a sweetheart. She helps me go outside and clean off my shoes and everything. And I'm tired, mind you, because it was a late night, right?
Right.
Didn't get good sleep. And we get it all taken care of, and she's so nice. And I ask her all of these questions, and I pick up a little bit of a memory impairment. And I'm getting ready to go, and I notice we walk, and I look at that cat, and I go, I'm so sorry about your cat. And she goes, what do you mean? And I said, well, your cat died. She goes, my cat died? And she says, when? And she runs over to it, and she goes, no! And she's freaking out about her cat.
Oh, no.
That must have been there for, I don't know how long it takes.
A long time. She just thought the cat was sleeping for months.
Yes. And I said, oh, she does have a memory impairment here, you know?
Right,
She had capacity, but she had a severe memory impairment. Not severe. I'd say she had a moderate memory impairment, but she was better in the afternoon. And I like to tell that story, especially when I'm training
investigators. I'm laughing because I'm better in the afternoon, too. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. I don't know why you made me come here in the morning. I'm so happy to be here. And she what I ended up doing is I ended up just setting up a network of people to help her and said, call the hotline if you start to have concerns that she is not having her – every need there was met. She just had trouble with –
it's like selective memory loss of certain things.
Yeah.
She just thought the cat was sleeping every time it was on the couch and didn't realize it had actually
– well, maybe the day before, and maybe by that afternoon it would have been – you know, there's sundowners that we have to pay attention to. That's a term in the industry. People who suffer from dementia tend to be better – at certain times of the day, but sundowners is a misnomer. It might be sun upper, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So people are different, you know?
Depends on
when you catch them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And what about self-neglect and adults that have disabilities?
Mm-hmm. Well, self-neglect, these are people who they don't bathe. They may not bathe. They may not be eating. They may have trouble ambulating. All the different things that we do every day, they may not do. Now, why don't they do it? Do they do it because they can't, or do they do it because they don't want to? A lot of times, they don't want to. You know, it's not self-neglect to drink all day if that's what you want to do. But are you not taking care of your daily living activities, or paying your bills, or taking your medicine because of it? Then we consider it self-neglect. It's not self-neglect just to say, be an alcoholic, perhaps, or to, you know, any variety of things that you can do. With self-neglect, if they have capacity to consent and they want help, we'll get them help. They may have to go on a waiting list if it's not a high-risk situation. Perhaps we will ask them if they want to go to an assisted living facility. We will help locate one for them, and the assisted living facility will come pick them up and bring a van and take their stuff. You know, not everything.
Yeah.
Sometimes they can even go with their pets. There's plenty.
That's why a lot of people. I'd be one of those people. Yeah. I wouldn't want to leave without my pet.
Yes.
You know, that would be a big thing. Yes. So, what kind of allegations? You were talking a little bit earlier, but what kind of allegations do you investigate?
We investigate. Say with abuse, we investigate physical abuse, which is like burns and bone fractures, cuts. We investigate sexual abuse.
Oh my god!
Always in conjunction with law enforcement. Law enforcement will conduct their own criminal investigation while we do our social service investigation. Law enforcement is in charge of arresting people. We're in charge of making sure they're safe. Sexual abuse, there's different kinds of sexual abuse. We do that. That tends to be a report that we get in a facility, unfortunately.
That's sad.
Not that this is a common report, but we do investigate deaths. We'll get a call to our hotline that somebody died, and there's a concern that it was due to abuse or neglect, not just natural causes. We do have we have a nurse on staff. She can assist us with records review, so that we can work towards determine findings from a medical point of view. She can also go out and help us assess capacity if we're not quite sure. We investigate various kinds of neglect. Inadequate supervision, as I talked about, is the number one that we investigate. We investigate medical neglect, environmental neglect, such as conditions that are hazardous. There was, hoarding is – no. Everybody knows what hoarding is now thanks to cable TV, right?
Yep.
And hoarding – I would rather actually go into a house that's full of stuff, like one that I went to where I opened the front door. She said, go ahead and go in if you want. And I opened the front door. She was coming home with a truck full of more stuff.
Oh, no.
Her yard was covered with stuff. And I said, I need to see the inside of the house. She said, feel free. The door's open. I open it, and it's like a practical joke. It's like somebody opened the roof and stuffed it as full as they could so there was not a crevice.
Yeah, that anything clear? Oh, gosh. So, it's like, what are they going to do with all that stuff? Yeah. But they feel like they need it.
Yeah.
And I find people that grew up like during the Depression, mm-hmm. I think, yes. who had nothing tend to be the ones that hoard.
Yeah, absolutely. We see it in a certain kind of population. That was like when you – it's like that on TV when somebody opens a door and it's got a concrete wall. That's what it was like, but with stuff. I've had instances where I've had to leave a residence, and on one occasion I had to get in the car. Before I got in the car, I was getting bugs off of me the whole time I was there. They were jumping on me. And when I went outside, I knew that if I brought a bug home, I was going to be in big trouble.
Right.
So I essentially undressed in my car. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It would have been awful if the police came by while I was doing that.
Yeah, you got to leave an extra change of clothes in your car at that point.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And I did it just to shake them off,
Right, so, right. Yeah. That's scary. Yeah. Now, define exploitation in the context of senior abuse.
Yes. Exploitation, and I made a joke about this before, we had this monster long definition in our statutes about exploitation. But it's essentially using threats or intimidation to deprive the vulnerable adult of their property or assets. And when we look at exploitation, there's two ways that an alleged perpetrator can do that. They can do it because they stand in a position of trust and confidence. This is like a power of attorney. Often that's a family member. The power of attorney can abuse their authority and deprive the vulnerable adult of assets by basically using the vulnerable adult's money for themselves.
Right. You hear a lot of stories. That's very, very, very sad.
And then the other side of it is somebody who doesn't stand in a position of trust and confidence but knows while they're dealing with the vulnerable adult that they lack capacity. You may not be a power of attorney. You may not even know someone. But if you know that they lack the ability to make decisions, and you still do business with them in the community, you could be exploiting that individual. And our approach to it is similar to law enforcement's approach to it.
Okay, and the perpetrators, you talked a little bit about, it's usually somebody that they know. Mm-hmm. And you get notified when someone makes a call to your hotline, pretty much. That's how
right.
you guys get notified on it.
Right.
What's the process once you get a phone call?
So, like, when they call into the hotline, first, it's important to know what you do to call into the hotline, because
okay.
they screen out calls. So you have to be prepared when you call the hotline. You should and know that your identity is confidential by law. Investigators will not release reporter information while they're doing an investigation or even after. So you have anonymity. But you need to prepare to provide the hotline with the names of all the subjects involved, what's wrong with that vulnerable adult, that they're a vulnerable adult, what's their impairment, where to find them. It's actually really important to know, to discuss what dangers there might be to the investigators. Investigators have been hurt responding to houses where there's actually one last quick story for you. Mm-hmm. There was an investigation about 5 years ago where the investigator got a report that this gentleman, he didn't have his medication. He didn't have his diabetic medication, his insulin. It was kind of a run-of-the-mill case. The investigator shows up and to try to assist him in getting his medication, calls the doctor right on the spot. And this gentleman he's just a little bit off. After they do a discussion, she says to him, "Look, I'm worried about you're not getting your meds. Maybe you should go to the hospital." And he had just gotten out of the hospital, and he was wishy-washy about going to the hospital. And he finally says, "Go ahead and call the ambulance, and I'll go ahead and go to the hospital." And he goes to his bedroom, and just as EMS shows up, he shoots himself in his bedroom.
He's not going to leave the house.
Right.
Yes.
Well, and the mm-hmm. one, there's a lot of problems with this, but one of them is nobody mentioned that he has guns.
Right.
Yeah. And so when you call the hotline, talk about what dangers there are. Are there guns? Are there dogs? Is there somebody in the house that has a violent criminal history? That type of thing. Once the hotline dispatches it out, investigator will respond within 24 hours. Unless the report is screened out, the investigator will call the reporter to let them know, "Hey, we got your report. Let's go over these allegations again. Make sure we understand what you're saying," and then the investigation will go from there.
Okay, now we only have a few minutes before we wrap up, so I want to mention that you have different types of service programs, and I'm going to have you give your website at the end of the show, because I've looked through it and I know it lists all those programs. And you know, obviously, you guys you take action depending upon what's happening in that case. What happens if the police are involved? If it's a criminal action, like, do you get follow up from them on if there's a criminal action?
Yes, well, actually, we may keep our investigations have to be completed within 60 days. But we may keep it open longer if the police have an ongoing criminal investigation, because we do work together with them. But our investigation is essentially complete once we have the victim safe and we're able to determine what the findings are. The police may investigate their companion case for years. They might do that. They will arrest if necessary. They will refer it to the state attorney's office for prosecution. They, like any other law enforcement investigation, they will arrest subjects in our cases and send them for prosecution.
That's good. It's sad that any of that even has to happen, that any of this – that you even I hate to say it, but it's sad that you even have to have a job in doing this, because people just don't do the right thing. Just tell me quickly, what are the six principles?
Yes, there's a kind of a philosophy locally in our office, and some of these are common to social services, but there's six philosophies that we go by. One is the client's right to self-determination. We want the vulnerable adult to choose what they want to do. We like to give them options if they have capacity to consent. What would you like to do? If that's what you want to do, we'll help you do it. We're not going to make you do it. The use of the least restrictive alternative treatment, meaning we're not going to rush and put them in an assisted living facility if they really can get by with some in-home supports. We like people to remain in their home if they can do that safely. We want to keep families together. We want to use community-based services whenever we can, rather than it's cheaper, you know?
Right.
You know, budgets are tight nowadays, you know? we want to avoid blaming the vulnerable adults anytime something might happen to them. Senior abuse, it's not your fault if you're abused. We may try to get them to understand that they have the power to make changes in their life, and we encourage them to do that, but we never blame them. And finally, inadequate or inappropriate intervention may be worse than none at all. Sometimes the best thing to do is leave them alone. That's might be the best thing to do. You can make a situation worse if you force the issue and you force one of the vulnerable adults and seniors in our community to do something.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, as you become older, I think a lot of it is depression. I mean, especially if they don't have any family member. I sit here and go, wow, by the time I'm old, my family pretty much will be gone, and who will I have? And that's when people, I think, go into that depression. They don't want to leave their house because they feel like they're attached to it, and they know everything, and they're familiar with everything. When you have to leave the house, mm-hmm. they just don't want to do it. So I guess I can kind of understand a lot of what you're talking about. Any other quick stories you want to share with me?
There was, yes, one of, you know, these are people. That's something we can't forget about. These are people. Right. And, you know, we do have investigators have a very busy, tough job. And there's 50,000 cases that come in right now a year. But what we can never forget, and what nobody in the community should ever forget, is that these are human beings. And I was reminded of that when I was an investigator. It was another one of these older people. I get a report that this gentleman is at a nursing home and his daughter is exploiting him. And it's, you know, the nursing home is aware of this because his bill's not being paid.
Right.
And she's supposed to be paying his bill, and he's $10,000 in arrears after a few months of his bill not being paid. So I go to see him, and he was 100 years old that day.
Oh, my gosh.
That was his 100th-year-old birthday, and he was a black man, and he was also blind. And I was one of those investigators who wanted to keep my caseload managed and low. I wanted to save time to help the ones that really needed it the most. And I had a policy that I had to be in and out in a certain amount of time. And I stayed for 2.5 hours and talked to this man.
Wow.
Because he had the most interesting life that I'd ever heard, really, you know. And I've met a lot of people in 17 years with DCF.
Yeah, it's a shame that a lot of these people don't write books because they're walking history books. Yeah. Well, Mike Mahoney, I want to thank you very much for helping me. How can people get a hold of you or your organization?
Well, if you want to call the Florida Abuse Hotline, you can call 1-800-96-ABUSE. That's the easy way to remember it. That's 1-800-962-2873. You can also fax in your report if you want. 1-800-914-0004. And we're modern. You can go online and make a report at www.reportabuse.dcf.state.fl.us. And if somebody wants to email me, I'm at michael.mahoney@myflfamilies.com.
Terrific. Thanks so much for joining me today, Mike. Thanks for
joining
us. Yep, you're very welcome. And join us next week on The World of Lori Zook.